removable dourness, and neither was aware of failure. In fact, they both thought their den a triumph and a blessing. Nancy because it was a place where she could entertain the gang without disturbing her mother, and Kenyon because here he could be alone, free to bang, saw, and mess with his inventions, the newest of which was an electric deep-dish frying pan. Adjoining the den was a furnace room, which contained a tool-littered table piled with some of his other works in progress, an amplifying unit, an elderly wind-up Victrola that he was restoring to service. Kenyon resembled neither of his parents physically. His crew-cut hair was hemp-colored, and he was 6 feet tall and lanky, though hefty enough to have once rescued a pair of full-grown sheep by carrying them 2 miles through a blizzard. Sturdy, strong, but cursed with the lanky boy's lack of muscular coordination. This defect, aggravated by an inability to function without glasses, prevented him from taking more than a token part in those team sports, basketball, baseball, that were the main occupation of most of the boys who might have been his friends. He had only one close friend, Bob Jones, the son of Taylor Jones, whose ranch was a mile west of the Clutter home. Out in rural Kansas, boys start driving cars very young. Kenyon was 11 when his father allowed him to buy, with money he had earned raising sheep, an old truck with a Model A engine. The Coyote Wagon, he and Bob called it. Not far from River Valley Farm, there is a mysterious stretch of countryside known as the Sand Hills. It is like a beach without an ocean, and at night coyotes slink among the dunes, assembling in hordes to howl. On moonlit evenings, the boys would descend upon them, set them running, and try to outrace them in the wagon. They seldom did, for the scrawniest coyote can hit 50 miles an hour, whereas the wagon's top speed was 35. But it was a wild and beautiful kind of fun, the wagon skidding across the sand, the fleeing coyotes framed against the moon. As Bob said, it sure made your heart hurry. Equally intoxicating and more profitable were the rabbit roundups the two boys conducted. Kenyon was a good shot and his friend a better one, and between them they sometimes delivered 50 rabbits to the rabbit factory, a Garden City processing plant that paid 10 cents a head for the animals, which were then quick frozen and shipped to mink growers. But what meant most to Kenyon, and Bob too, was their weekend, overnight hunting hikes along the shores of the river. Wandering, wrapping up in blankets, listening at sunrise for the noise of wings, moving toward the sound on tiptoe, and then, sweetest of all, swaggering homeward with a dozen duck dinners swinging from their belts. But lately, things had changed between Kenyon and his friend. They had not quarreled. There had been no overt falling out. Nothing had happened except that Bob, who was 16, had started going with a girl, which meant that Kenyon, a year younger and still very much the adolescent bachelor, could no longer count on his companionship. Bob told him, "When you're my age, you'll feel different. I used to think the same as you. Women. So what? But then you get to talking to some woman and it's mighty nice. You'll see." Kenyon doubted it. He could not conceive of ever wanting to waste an hour on any girl that might be spent with guns, horses, tools, machinery, even a book. If Bob was unavailable, then he would rather be alone. For in temperament, he was not in the least Mr. Clutter's son, but rather Bonnie's child, a sensitive and reticent boy. His contemporaries thought him standoffish, yet forgave him, saying, "Oh, Kenyon. It's just that he lives in a world of his own." Leaving the varnish to dry, he went on to another chore, one that took him out of doors. He wanted to tidy up his mother's flower garden, a treasured patch of disheveled foliage that grew beneath her bedroom window. When he got there, he found one of the hired men loosening earth with a spade. Paul Helm, the husband of the housekeeper. "Seen that car?" Mr. Helm asked. Yes, Kenyon had seen a car in the driveway. A gray Buick, standing outside the entrance to his father's office. "Thought you might know who it was." "Not unless it's Mr. Johnson. Dad said he was expecting him." "Mr. Helm. The late Mr. Helm. He died of a stroke the following March, was a somber man in his late 50s whose withdrawn manner veiled a nature keenly curious and watchful. He liked to know what was going on. "Which Johnson?"
"The insurance fellow."
Mr. Helm grunted. "Your dad must be laying in a stack of it. That car's been here, I'd say, 3 hours." The chill of oncoming dusk shivered through the air, and though the sky was still deep blue, lengthening shadows emanated from the garden's tall chrysanthemum stalks. Nancy's cat frolicked among them, catching its paws in the twine with which Kenyon and the old man were now tying plants. Suddenly, Nancy herself came jogging across the fields aboard Fat Babe. Babe, returning from her Saturday treat, a bathe in the river. Teddy the dog accompanied them, and all three were water-splashed and shining. "You'll catch cold," Mr. Helm said. Nancy laughed. She had never been ill. Not once. Sliding off Babe, she sprawled on the grass at the edge of the garden and seized her cat, dangled him above her, and kissed his nose and whiskers. Kenyon was disgusted. "Kissing animals on the mouth."
"You used to kiss Skeeter," she reminded him.
"Skeeter was a horse. A beautiful horse. A strawberry stallion he had raised from a foal. How that Skeeter could take offense." "You use a horse too hard," his father had cautioned him. "One day you'll ride the life out of Skeeter." And he had. While Skeeter was streaking down a road with his master astride him, his heart failed, and he stumbled and was dead. Now, a year later, Kenyon still mourned him, even though his father, taking pity on him, had promised him the pick of next spring's foals.
"Kenyon," Nancy said, "do you think Tracy will be able to talk? By Thanksgiving?"
Tracy, not yet a year old, was her nephew, the son of Eviana, the sister to whom she felt particularly close. Beverly was Kenyon's favorite.
"It would thrill me to pieces to hear him say Aunt Nancy or Uncle Kenyon. Wouldn't you like to hear him say that? I mean, don't you love being an uncle?"
"Kenyon?"
"Good grief, why can't you ever answer me?"
"Because you're silly," he said, tossing her the head of a flower, a wilted dahlia, which she jammed into her hair. Mr. Helm picked up his spade. Crows cawed, sundown was near, but his home was not. The lane of Chinese elms had turned into a tunnel of darkening green, and he lived at the end of it, half a mile away. "Evening," he said, and started his journey. But once he looked back. And that, he was to testify the next day, was the last I seen them. Nancy leading old Babe off to the barn. Like I said, nothing out of the ordinary. The black Chevrolet was again parked, this time in front of a Catholic hospital on the outskirts of Emporia. Under continued needling,
"That's your trouble. You think there's only one right way. Dick's way."
Dick had surrendered. While Perry waited in the car, he had gone into the hospital to try and buy a pair of black stockings from a nun. This rather unorthodox method of obtaining them had been Perry's inspiration. Nuns, he had argued, were certain to have a supply. The notion presented one drawback, of course. Nuns, and anything pertaining to them, were bad luck, and Perry was most respectful of his superstitions. Some others were the number 15, red hair, white flowers, priests crossing a road, snakes appearing in a dream. Still, it couldn't be helped. The compulsively superstitious person is also very often a serious believer in fate. That was the case with Perry. He was here and embarked on the present errand not because he wished to be, but because fate had arranged the matter. He could prove it, though he had no intention of doing so, at least within Dick's hearing, for the proof would involve his confessing the true and secret motive behind his return to Kansas. A piece of parole violation he had decided upon for a reason quite unrelated to Dick's score or Dick's summoning letter. The reason was that several weeks earlier he had learned that on Thursday, November 12th, another of his former cellmates was being released from Kansas State Penitentiary at Lansing, and more than anything in the world, he desired a reunion with this man, his real and only friend, the brilliant Willie J.
During the first of his 3 years in prison, Perry had observed Willie J. from a distance, with interest but with apprehension. If one wished to be thought a tough specimen, intimacy with Willie J. seemed unwise. He was the chaplain's clerk, a slender Irishman with prematurely gray hair and gray, melancholy eyes. His tenor voice was the glory of the prison's choir. Even Perry, though he was contemptuous of any exhibition of piety, felt upset when he heard Willie J. sing the Lord's Prayer. The hymn's grave language sung in so credulous a spirit moved him, made him wonder a little at the justice of his contempt. Eventually, prodded by a slightly alerted religious curiosity, he approached Willie J., and the chaplain's clerk, at once responsive, thought he divined in the cripple-legged bodybuilder, with the misty gaze and the prim, smoky voice, a poet, something rare and savable. An ambition to bring this boy to God engulfed him. His hopes of succeeding accelerated when one day Perry produced a pastel drawing he had made, a large, in no way technically naive portrait of Jesus. Lansing's Protestant chaplain, the Reverend James Post, so valued it that he hung it in his office, where it hangs still. A slick and pretty savior, with Willie J.'s full lips and grieving eyes. The picture was the climax of Perry's never very earnest spiritual quest, and, ironically, the termination of it. He had judged his Jesus a piece of hypocrisy, an attempt to fool and betray Willie J., for he was as unconvinced of God as ever. Yet should he admit this and risk forfeiting the one friend who had ever truly understood him? Hod, Joe, Jesse, travelers straying through a world where last names were seldom exchanged, these had been his buddies. Never anyone like Willie J., who was, in Perry's opinion, way above average intellectually, perceptive as a well-trained psychologist. How was it possible that so gifted a man had wound up in Lansing? That was what amazed Perry. The answer, which he knew but rejected as an evasion of the deeper, the human question, was plain to simpler minds. The chaplain's clerk, then 38, was a thief, a small-scale robber who over a period of 20 years had served sentences in 5 different states. Perry decided to speak out. He was sorry, but it was not for him. Heaven, hell, saints, divine mercy. And if Willie J.'s affection was founded on the prospect of Perry's someday joining him at the foot of the cross, then he was deceived and their friendship false, a counterfeit, like the portrait. As usual, Willie J. understood. Disheartened but not disenchanted, he had persisted in courting Perry's soul until the day of its possessor's parole and departure, on the eve of which he wrote Perry a farewell letter, whose last paragraph ran, "You are a man of extreme passion, a hungry man not quite sure where his appetite lies, a deeply frustrated man striving to project his individuality against a backdrop of rigid conformity. You exist in a half-world suspended between 2 superstructures, one self-expression and the other self-destruction. You are strong, but there is a flaw in your strength, and unless you learn to control it, the flaw will prove stronger than your strength and defeat you." The flaw? Explosive emotional reaction out of all proportion to the occasion. Why? Why this unreasonable anger at the sight of others who were happy or content? This growing contempt for people and the desire to hurt them? All right. You think they're fools. You despise them because they're morals. Their happiness is the source of your frustration and resentment. But these are dreadful enemies you carry within yourself. In time, destructive as bullets. Mercifully, a bullet kills its victim. This other bacteria, permitted to age, does not kill a man, but leaves in its wake the hulk of a creature torn and twisted. There is still fire within his being, but it is kept alive by casting upon it faggots of scorn and hate. He may successfully accumulate, but he does not accumulate success, for he is his own enemy and is kept from truly enjoying his achievements. Perry, flattered to be the subject of this sermon, had let Dick read it. And Dick, who took a dim view of Willie J., had called the letter just more a Billy Graham cracker's hooey, adding, "Faggots of scorn. He's the faggot." Of course, Perry had expected this reaction, and secretly he welcomed it. For his friendship with Dick, whom he had scarcely known until his final few months in Lansing, was an outgrowth of, and counterbalanced to, the intensity of his admiration for the chaplain's clerk. Perhaps Dick was shallow, or even, as Willie J. claimed, a vicious blusterer. All the same, Dick was full of fun, and he was shrewd, a realist. He cut through things. There were no clouds in his head or straw in his hair. Moreover, unlike Willie J., he was not critical of Perry's exotic aspirations. He was willing to listen, catch fire, share with him those visions of guaranteed treasure lurking in Mexican seas, Brazilian jungles. After Perry's parole, 4 months elapsed, months of rattling around in a fifth-hand $100 Ford, rolling from Reno to Las Vegas, from Bellingham, Washington to Buell, Idaho, and it was in Buell, where he had found temporary work as a truck driver, that Dick's letter reached him. "Friend P. came out in August, and after you left, I met someone. You do not know him, but he put me on to something we could bring off beautiful. A cinch. The perfect score." Until then, Perry had not imagined that he would ever see Dick again. Or Willie J. But they had both been much in his thoughts, and especially the latter, who in memory had grown 10 feet tall, a gray-haired wise man haunting the hallways of his mind. "You pursue the negative," Willie J. had informed him once in one of his lectures. "You want not to give a damn, to exist without responsibility, without faith or friends or warmth." In the solitary, comfortless course of his recent driftings, Perry had over and over again reviewed this indictment and had decided it was unjust. He did give a damn, but who had ever given a damn about him? His father? Yes, up to a point. A girl or two, but that was a long story. No one else except Willie J. himself. And only Willie J. had ever recognized his worth, his potentialities, had acknowledged that he was not just an undersized, over-muscled half-breed, had seen him, for all the moralizing, as he saw himself. Exceptional. Rare. Artistic. In Willie J., his vanity had found support, his sensibility shelter, and the 4 month exile from this high carat appreciation had made it more alluring than any dream of buried gold. So when he received Dick's invitation and realized that the date Dick proposed for his coming to Kansas more or less coincided with the time of Willie J.'s release, he knew what he must do. He drove to Las Vegas, sold his junk heap car, packed his collection of maps, old letters, manuscripts, and books, and bought a ticket for a Greyhound bus. The journey's aftermath was up to fate. If things didn't work out with Willie J., then he might consider Dick's proposition. As it turned out, the choice was between Dick and nothing. For when Perry's bus reached Kansas City on the evening of November 12th, Willie J., whom he'd been unable to advise of his coming, had already left town. Left, in fact, only 5 hours earlier, from the same terminal at which Perry arrived. That much he had learned by telephoning the Reverend Mr. Post, who further discouraged him by declining to reveal his former clerk's exact destination. "He's headed east," the chaplain said, "to find opportunities. A decent job, and a home with some good people who were willing to help him." And Perry, hanging up, had felt dizzy with anger and disappointment. But what, he wondered when the anguish subsided, had he really expected from a reunion with Willie J.? Freedom had separated them. As free men, they had nothing in common, were opposites, who could never have formed a team. Certainly not one capable of embarking on the skin-diving south-of-the-border adventures he and Dick had plotted. Nevertheless, if he had not missed Willie J., if they could have been together for even an hour, Perry was quite convinced, just knew, that he would not now be loitering outside a hospital waiting for Dick to emerge with a pair of black stockings. Dick returned empty-handed. "No go," he announced, with a furtive casualness that made Perry suspicious. "Are you sure? Sure you even asked?"
"Sure I did."
"I don't believe you. I think you went in there, hung around a couple of minutes, and came out."
"Okay, sugar. Whatever you say."
Dick started the car. After they had traveled in silence a while, Dick patted Perry on the knee.
"Oh, come on," he said. "It was a pukey idea. What the hell would they have thought? Me barging in there like it was a goddamn five and dime?"
Perry said, "Maybe it's just as well. Nuns are a bad luck bunch." The Garden City representative of New York Life Insurance smiled as he watched Mr. Clutter uncap a Parker pen and open a checkbook. He was reminded of a local jest. "Know what they say about you, Herb? Say, since haircuts went to $1.50, Herb writes the barber a check."
"That's correct," replied Mr. Clutter.
Like royalty, he was famous for never carrying cash.
"That's the way I do business. When those tax fellas come poking around, canceled checks are your best friend."
With the check written but not yet signed, he swiveled back in his desk chair and seemed to ponder. The agent, a stocky, somewhat bald, rather informal man named Bob Johnson, hoped his client wasn't having last-minute doubts. Herb was hard-headed, a slow man to make a deal. Johnson had worked over a year to clinch this sale. But no, his customer was merely experiencing what Johnson called the solemn moment, a phenomenon familiar to insurance salesmen. The mood of a man insuring his life is not unlike that of a man signing his will. Thoughts of mortality must occur.
"Yes, yes," said Mr. Clutter, as though conversing with himself. "I've plenty to be grateful for. Wonderful things in my life."
Framed documents commemorating milestones in his career gleamed against the walnut walls of his office. A college diploma, a map of River Valley Farm, agricultural awards, an ornate certificate bearing the signatures of Dwight D. Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles, which cited his services to the Federal Farm Credit Board.
"The kids. We've been lucky there. Shouldn't say it, but I'm real proud of them. Take Kenyon. Right now he kinda leans toward being an engineer or a scientist, but you can't tell me my boy's not a born rancher. God willing, he'll run this place someday. You ever meet Eviana's husband? Don Jarchow? Veterinarian. I can't tell you how much I think of that boy. Veer, too. Veer English. The boy my girl Beverly had the good sense to settle on. If anything ever happened to me, I'm sure I could trust those fellas to take responsibility. Bonnie by herself. Bonnie wouldn't be able to carry on an operation like this." Johnson, a veteran at listening to ruminations of this sort, knew it was time to intervene. "Why, Herb," he said, "you're a young man, 48. And from the looks of you, from what the medical report tells us, we're likely to have you around a couple of weeks more."
Mr. Clutter straightened, reached again for his pen.
"Tell the truth, I feel pretty good. And pretty optimistic. I've got an idea a man could make some real money around here the next few years."
While outlining his schemes for future financial betterment, he signed the check and pushed it across his desk. The time was 6:10, and the agent was anxious to go. His wife would be waiting supper.
"It's been a pleasure, Herb."
"Same here, fellow." They shook hands. Then, with a merited sense of victory, Johnson picked up Mr. Clutter's check and deposited it in his billfold. It was the first payment on a $40,000 policy that, in the event of death by accidental means, paid double indemnity.
"And he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me I am his own,
and the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known. With the aid of his guitar, Perry had sung himself into a happier humor. He knew the lyrics of some 200 hymns and ballads, a repertoire ranging from the old Rugged Cross to Cole Porter. And in addition to the guitar, he could play the harmonica, the accordion, the banjo, and the xylophone. In one of his favorite theatrical fantasies, his stage name was Perry O'Parsons, a star who billed himself as the one-man symphony. Dick said, "How about a cocktail?" Personally, Perry didn't care what he drank, for he was not much of a drinker. Dick, however, was choosy, and in bars his usual choice was an orange blossom. From the car's glove compartment, Perry fetched a pint bottle containing a ready-mixed compound of orange flavoring and vodka. They passed the bottle to and fro. Though dusk had established itself, Dick, doing a steady 60 miles an hour, was still driving without headlights. But then the road was straight. The country was as level as a lake, and other cars were seldom sighted. This was out there, or getting near it. "Christ," said Perry, glaring at the landscape, flat and limitless under the sky's cold, lingering green. Empty and lonesome except for the far-between flickerings of farmhouse lights. He hated it, as he hated the Texas plains, the Nevada desert. Spaces horizontal and sparsely inhabited had always induced in him a depression accompanied by agoraphobic sensations. Seaports were his heart's delight. Crowded, clanging, ship-clogged, sewage-scented cities like Yokohama, where as an American Army private he'd spent a summer during the Korean War. Christ. And they told me to keep away from Kansas. Never set my pretty foot here again. As though they were barring me from heaven. And just look at it. Just feast your eyes. Dick handed him the bottle, the contents reduced by half. "Save the rest," Dick said. "We may need it." "Remember, Dick? All that talk about getting a boat? I was thinking. We could buy a boat in Mexico. Something cheap but sturdy. And we could go to Japan. Sail right across the Pacific. It's been done. Thousands of people have done it. I'm not conning you, Dick. You'd go for Japan. Wonderful, gentle people, with manners like flowers. Really considerate. Not just out for your dough. And the women. You've never met a real woman." "Yes, I have," said Dick, who claimed still to be in love with his honey-blonde first wife, though she had remarried. "There are these baths. One place called the Dream Pool. You stretch out, and beautiful, knockout-type girls come and scrub you head to toe." "You told me." Dick's tone was curt. "So? Can't I repeat myself?" "Later. Let's talk about it later. Hell, man, I've got plenty on my mind." Dick switched on the radio. Perry switched it off. Ignoring Dick's protest, he strummed his guitar. "I came to the garden alone while the dew was still on the roses, and the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses." A full moon was forming at the edge of the sky. The following Monday, while giving evidence prior to taking a lie detector test, young Bobby Rupp described his last visit to the Clutter home. "There was a full moon, and I thought maybe if Nancy wanted to, we might go for a drive. Drive out to McKinney Lake. Or go to the movies in Garden City. But when I called her, it must have been about 10 of 7, she said she'd have to ask her father. Then she came back and said the answer was no, because we'd stayed out so late the night before. But said why didn't I come over and watch television? I've spent a lot of time at the Clutters, watching television. See, Nancy's the only girl I ever dated. I'd known her all my life. We'd gone to school together from the first grade. Always, as long as I can remember, she was pretty and popular. A person, even when she was a little kid. I mean, she just made everybody feel good about themselves. The first time I dated her was when we were in the 8th grade. Most of the boys in our class wanted to take her to the 8th grade graduation dance, and I was surprised. I was pretty proud when she said she would go with me. We were both 12. My dad lent me the car, and I drove her to the dance. The more I saw her, the more I liked her. The whole family, too. There wasn't any other family like them. Not around here, not that I know of. Mr. Clutter may have been more strict about some things, religion and so on, but he never tried to make you feel he was right and you were wrong. We lived 3 miles west of the Clutter place. I used to walk it back and forth, but I always worked summers, and last year I'd saved enough to buy my own car, a 55 Ford. So I drove over there, got there a little after 7. I didn't see anybody on the road or on the lane that leads up to the house, or anybody outside. Just old Teddy. He barked at me. The lights were on downstairs, in the living room and in Mr. Clutter's office. The second floor was dark, and I figured Mrs. Clutter must be asleep, if she was home. You never knew whether she was or not, and I never asked. But I found out I was right, because later in the evening Kenyon wanted to practice his horn. He played baritone horn in the school band, and Nancy told him not to because he would wake up Mrs. Clutter. Anyway, when I got there, they had finished supper and Nancy had cleaned up, put all the dishes in the dishwasher, and the three of them, the two kids and Mr. Clutter, were in the living room. So we sat around like any other night, Nancy and I on the couch, and Mr. Clutter in his chair, that stuffed rocker. He wasn't watching the television so much as he was reading a book. A Rover Boy, one of Kenyon's books. Once he went out to the kitchen and came back with 2 apples. He offered one to me, but I didn't want it, so he ate them both. He had very white teeth. He said apples were why. Nancy was wearing socks and soft slippers, blue jeans, I think a green sweater. She was wearing a gold wristwatch and an ID bracelet I gave her last January for her 16th birthday, with her name on one side and mine on the other, and she had on a ring, some little silver thing she bought a summer ago when she went to Colorado with the Kidwells. It wasn't my ring, our ring. See, a couple weeks back, she got sore at me and said she was going to take off our ring for a while. When your girl does that, it means you're on probation. I mean, sure, we had fusses. Everybody does. All the kids that go steady. What happened was I went to this friend's wedding, the reception, and drank a beer. 1 bottle of beer, and Nancy got to hear about it. Some tattle told her I was roaring drunk. Well, she was stone, wouldn't say hello for a week. But lately we'd been getting on good as ever, and I believe she was about ready to wear our ring again. Okay. The first show was called The Man and the Challenge, Channel 11, about some fellas in the Arctic. Then we saw a Western, and after that a spy adventure. 5 Fingers. Mike Hammer came on at 9:30, then the news. But Kenyon didn't like anything, mostly because we wouldn't let him pick the programs. He criticized everything, and Nancy kept telling him to hush up. They always quibbled, but actually, they were very close. Closer than most brothers and sisters. I guess partly it was because they'd been alone together so much, what with Mrs. Clutter away and Mr. Clutter gone to Washington or wherever. I know Nancy loved Kenyon very specially, but I don't think even she or anybody exactly understood him. He seemed to be off somewhere. You never knew what he was thinking, never even knew if he was looking at you, on account of he was slightly cockeyed. Some people said he was a genius, and maybe it was true. He sure did read a lot. But like I say, he was restless. He didn't want to watch the TV. He wanted to practice his horn, and when Nancy wouldn't let him, I remember Mr. Clutter told him why didn't he go down to the basement, the recreation room where nobody could hear him. But he didn't want to do that either. The phone rang once. Twice? Gosh, I can't remember. Except that once the phone rang and Mr. Clutter answered it in his office. The door was open, that sliding door between the living room and the office, and I heard him say Van, so I knew he was talking to his partner, Mr. Van Vliet, and I heard him say that he had a headache but that it was getting better, and said he'd see Mr. Van Vliet on Monday. When he came back, yes, the Mike Hammer was just over. 5 minutes of news, then the weather report. Mr. Clutter always perked up when the weather report came on. It's all he ever really waited for. Like, the only thing that interested me was the sports, which came on next. After the sports ended, that was 10:30, and I got up to go. Nancy walked me out. We talked a while and made a date to go to the movies Sunday night. A picture all the girls were looking forward to. Blue denim. Then she ran back in the house and I drove away. It was as clear as day. The moon was so bright, and cold and kind of windy. A lot of tumbleweed blowing about. But that's all I saw. Only now when I think back, I think somebody must have been hiding there. Maybe down among the trees. Somebody just waiting for me to leave. The travelers stopped for dinner at a restaurant in Great Bend. Perry, down to his last $15, was ready to settle for root beer and a sandwich, but Dick said no. They needed a solid tuck-in, and never mind the cost, the tab was his. They ordered 2 steaks medium rare, baked potatoes, french fries, fried onions, succotash, side dishes of macaroni and hominy, salad with Thousand Island dressing, cinnamon rolls, apple pie and ice cream, and coffee. To top it off, they visited a drugstore and selected cigars. In the same drugstore, they also bought 2 thick rolls of adhesive tape. As the black Chevrolet regained the highway and hurried on across a countryside imperceptibly ascending toward the colder, cracker-dry climate of the high wheat plains, Perry closed his eyes and dozed off into a food-dazed semi-slumber, from which he woke to hear a voice reading the 11 o'clock news. He rolled down a window and bathed his face in the flood of frosty air. Dick told him they were in Finney County. "We crossed the line 10 miles back," he said. The car was going very fast. Signs, their messages ignited by the car's headlights, flared up, flew by. "See the polar bears. Burtis Motors. World's largest free swim pool. Wheatlands Motel." And finally, a bit before street lamps began, "Howdy, stranger. Welcome to Garden City, a friendly place." They skirted the northern rim of the town. No one was abroad at this nearly midnight hour, and nothing was open except a string of desolately brilliant service stations. Dick turned into one. Herds Phillips, 66. A youngster appeared and asked, "Fill her up?" Dick nodded, and Perry, getting out of the car, went inside the station, where he locked himself in the men's room. His legs pained him, as they often did. They hurt as though his old accident had happened 5 minutes before. He shook 3 aspirins out of a bottle, chewed them slowly, for he liked the taste, and then drank water from the basin tap. He sat down on the toilet, stretched out his legs and rubbed them, massaging the almost unbendable knees. Dick had said they were almost there, only 7 miles more. He unzippered a pocket of his windbreaker and brought out a paper sack. Inside it were the recently purchased rubber gloves. They were glue-covered, sticky and thin, and as he inched them on, one tore. Not a dangerous tear, just a split between the fingers, but it seemed to him an omen. The doorknob turned, rattled. Dick said, "Want some candy? They got a candy machine out here." "No." "You okay?" "I'm fine." "Don't be all night." Dick dropped a dime in a vending machine, pulled the lever, and picked up a bag of jelly beans. Munching, he wandered back to the car and lounged there, watching the young attendant's efforts to rid the windshield of Kansas dust and the slime of battered insects. The attendant, whose name was James Spore, felt uneasy. Dick's eyes and sullen expression and Perry's strange, prolonged sojourn in the lavatory disturbed him. The next day, he reported to his employer, "We had some tough customers in here last night," but he did not think, then or for the longest while, to connect the visitors with the tragedy in Holcomb. Dick said, "Kinda slow around here." "Sure is," James Spore said. "You're the only body stopped here since 2 hours. Where are you coming from?"
"Kansas City."
"Here to hunt?"
"Just passing through."
"On our way to Arizona."
"We got jobs waiting there. Construction work."
"Any idea the mileage between here and Tucumcari, New Mexico?"
"Can't say I do."
$3.06. He accepted Dick's money, made change, and said, "You'll excuse me, sir? I'm doing a job. Putting a bumper on a truck." Dick waited, ate some jelly beans, impatiently gunned the motor, sounded the horn. Was it possible that he had misjudged Perry's character? That Perry, of all people, was suffering a sudden case of blood bubbles? A year ago, when they first encountered each other, he'd thought Perry a good guy, if a bit stuck on himself, sentimental, too much the dreamer. He had liked him but not considered him especially worth cultivating until one day, Perry described a murder, telling how, simply for the hell of it, he had killed a colored man in Las Vegas, beaten him to death with a bicycle chain. The anecdote elevated Dick's opinion of little Perry. He began to see more of him, and, like Willie J., though for dissimilar reasons, gradually decided that Perry possessed unusual and valuable qualities. Several murderers, or men who boasted of murder or their willingness to commit it, circulated inside Lansing. But Dick became convinced that Perry was that rarity, a natural killer. Absolutely sane, but conscienceless, and capable of dealing, with or without motive, the coldest-blooded death blows. It was Dick's theory that such a gift could, under his supervision, be profitably exploited. Having reached this conclusion, he had proceeded to woo Perry, flatter him. Pretend, for example, that he believed all the buried treasure stuff and shared his beachcomber yearnings and seaport longings, none of which appealed to Dick, who wanted a regular life with a business of his own, a house, a horse to ride, a new car, and plenty of blonde chicken. It was important, however, that Perry not suspect this. Not until Perry, with his gift, had helped further Dick's ambitions. But perhaps it was Dick who had miscalculated, been duped. If so, if it developed that Perry was, after all, only an ordinary punk, then the party was over. The months of planning were wasted. There was nothing to do but turn and go. It mustn't happen. Dick returned to the station. The door to the men's room was still bolted. He banged on it. "For Christ's sake, Perry!" "In a minute." "What's the matter? You sick?" Perry gripped the edge of the wash basin and hauled himself to a standing position. His legs trembled. The pain in his knees made him perspire. He wiped his face with a paper towel. He unlocked the door and said, "Okay, let's go." Nancy's bedroom was the smallest, most personal room in the house. Girlish, and as frothy as a ballerina's tutu. Walls, ceiling, and everything else except a bureau and a writing desk were pink or blue or white. The white and pink bed, piled with blue pillows, was dominated by a big pink and white teddy bear, a shooting gallery prize that Bobby had won at the county fair. A cork bulletin board, painted pink, hung above a white-skirted dressing table. Dry gardenias, the remains of some ancient corsage, were attached to it, and old valentines, newspaper recipes, and snapshots of her baby nephew and of Susan Kidwell and of Bobby Rupp, Bobby caught in a dozen actions, swinging a bat, dribbling a basketball, driving a tractor, wading in bathing trunks at the edge of McKinney Lake, which was as far as he dared go, for he had never learned to swim. And there were photographs of the two together, Nancy and Bobby.